For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Kathy, in addition to being one of our founding members, is also one of our Sangha's psychologists or therapists. Anyway, tonight Kathy's going to speak to us. Thank you very much
for being here. Thank you for this opportunity. You have to excuse me. I've got new bifocals, and the line is not easy yet. I'm not used to this, so I'm going to be playing back and forth. The topic I'm talking about tonight is it has to do with conflict and versus cooperation. And thinking about this, I'm coming at it from the point of view of myself and personal issues, as well as the fact that I do a lot of couples therapy and see it in front of me. And so I end up thinking about the change process, or, you know, how do things get stuck and how do they get unstuck a good deal. And I also think that the same principles apply to what's going on in our culture right now, in that we're in a society that is extremely polarized, where different factions can't even talk to each other. You know, so we're kind of like pillars saying, I don't want to hear you. If you can't hear, can everyone hear me? Okay. You know, my own personal experience, you know, is I have discovered that I feel more intensely, I can get into conflict and get stuck with people that I'm close to. I also have been in couples therapy in the past myself. I have been divorced. Before that, I can remember times when I was in so much conflict that it was kind of like shut down. Stop communication, complete quiet for days, which is miserable. And that has taken me to the path of my own personal therapy, as well as meditation, to understand what got me to those places. You know, like I was hanging on to myself so much, like to understand what got me so entrenched. So now, as a therapist who I see couples, maybe a third of my practice, I get to watch this process and step back from it a little bit and think about it. What I see often is that couples come in sometimes and have an entrenched conflict that they enact in front of me. And I realize that what I'm seeing in the room is what goes on in their homes. And sometimes it's, you know, it's kind of like it's almost got a cadence. It's like one says this, the other one says that, the other one rebuts, the other one gets upset. And then, you know, it's like there's a dance and it can repeat itself exactly. And so you realize sometimes how stuck people are. And then, you know, the issue is, how do you help them get unstuck? Like, how do you break out of that? Because people can get into that so much that every time they interact, they move back into that same dance, you know, and they're just... So, you know, each has their own position and feels very strongly. Each feels threatened by not being listened to or taken seriously. And I do personally know what that feels like. I ask them sometimes, but also I think about exploring the problem and what's missing. At that time, there's no interest in finding out what's the feeling or concern behind their partner's position. There's also focus on each holding their own position and convincing the other of it. That's a primary sort of focus. There is need for opening up to a larger truth, broadening the discussion. That's part of what I'm trying to bring about. And I think we have to ask ourselves, when we find ourselves in these positions of intense conflict, what is the goal? Is our goal to win our point, or is it to get to a greater level of shared meaning or shared understanding? To get a sense of what it's like to walk in the other person's shoes, to connect around a shared concern, or to get to a cooperative stance. I'm going to tie this to one of the precepts in a minute, but it relates very much to the issue of non-attachment to the self that's talked about a good deal in Buddhism. And in some ways, it's like understanding and recognizing the dependent co-arising of a conversation. So what's missing sometimes is recognizing how much we are, that there is a co-arising process. I'll explain that what I mean more in just a minute. Let me just describe like some things that increase polarization and that increase dialogue. If we decide that the other person is hopelessly misguided with no useful input of any kind, then we are increasing the polarization. And we've all been there. I can get there with my siblings. I used to get there frequently with my parents when I was a young adult. That sense of that the other person is misguided and doesn't get it. If we're able to put ourselves into a mode of inquiry about the other person's experience and feelings and really listen, then we've moved a bit forward in creating a dialogue from which it's more possible to change. Also, what we know is that for most people, when there's an intense conflict and they're stuck, there usually are layers of feelings and emotions going on in either person's position. If one is to work in cooperation with the other, it's important to care about those layers. You know, whatever the issue is might be tied to previous experiences with this person or to your own past experience or to some personal insecurities. Being listened to opens up our capacity to listen. So we're more likely to be able to listen to the other if we feel we're listened to. Some of the goals are regaining areas of agreement, looking for overarching, like what do we have that we agree on? Regaining ability to take in how the other is experiencing the issue. Broaden the interaction, looking for overarching shared goals, and tuning into the layers of feeling underneath this particular conflict. There's a person by the name of Anatole Rapoport. You might be familiar with his name, but he is made major contributions in many areas. I think he died very recently, but he was a musician, he was a mathematician. He was also very active in the peace movement, in activism, and in systems theory. So he developed innovative systems looking at conflict and cooperation. We pull from some of what he did in couples therapy. For example, He said that there's no right and wrong. There are two valid realities. There are always two perceptions, two valid realities. The goal is for each person to try to understand the partner's reality. This is applying this to couples therapy. The partner's perception with an agreeable frame of agreed upon frame of reference. So I'm throwing a lot out here. I want to connect this a little bit to one of the precepts. And I'm pulling from Being Upright. Reb Anderson gave, illustration and description, explanation of the precepts. I think this is the 10 basic precepts. But anyway, it has to do with not praising self at the expense of others. I think that it really wouldn't matter which precept I chose, because I think the issue has to do with non-attachment to self. But he gives some really nice examples in this particular precept about attachment to the self and how it relates to not praising self at the expense of the other. He starts with, one of the main ways that we express our attachment to self is our constant effort to present ourselves in a favorable light. He goes on to talk about, this precept embraces the words self and other. Words exist conventionally. Through words, self and other dependently co-arise and are imbued with identity, and yet they are just words. If you study the self and clearly see that it is nothing more than a word, you will see that it lacks an independent self nature. With this insight, selfish motives are exposed and dropped. In the realm of Dharma, ignoring the dependent co-arising of self is the equivalent of original sin. It is the fundamental human disaster. Not seeing how all beings kindly support and sustain our virtue and goodness, it is possible to speak of our own virtue as something separate from others. In such a state of ignorance, you may think of your virtue as appearing almost in spite of others. You forget that it is really only due to the support of countless others that you accomplish anything of merit. He goes on to say, self-concern is often expressed by taking yourself too seriously. Ironically, taking yourself too seriously is a form of disrespecting yourself. It is taking yourself for granted. I think of this as being especially useful when we think of how do you shift from being locked in a polarized position or in a very tied to an argumentative position to moving out of it. For me, as I was thinking about this talk, I thought about, times when I have gotten upset and then stuck and unable to talk to someone. One incident that comes to mind, I was on a vacation with some family members and my brother and I got into a discussion about education in the United States today. And we're coming from very different positions. And unfortunately, I got mad and told him I thought he really didn't know what he was talking about. We couldn't stand to be together. We walked separate directions to get back to where we were staying. When I think back about that, I think I didn't have the patience to really listen because I thought he was missing the point and because he's my brother and I thought he should know better. So I was attached to him, and it was especially difficult coming from him. But that has to do with me. That's myself. That I was coming up against. And I have been working with that. I don't know if any of you saw the suggestions coming out from what the Democratic Party was putting out suggestions on if you encounter family members at Thanksgiving, you know, these are ways to pursue discussions, you know, to try to broaden some discussions. In the past with family members, when I thought they might be coming from a different position than I was on issues that were very, very important to me, I might just avoid it altogether or let them know I didn't want to talk about it because it was too difficult. And so I've tried not to do that so much lately. And, you know, the issue in Ferguson had just popped, you know, before I went away on Thanksgiving, and I had the day before just read the transcript of what happened in that trial and tried to understand how that could have happened. And so I was feeling pretty strongly about it and talking to some people at Thanksgiving. And one person kind of, you know, I broached the topic and she said, she'd just seen the report on the policeman and it sounded like he was really afraid for his life. And I started, you know, it was like I could feel that awful feeling of frustration and anger rising. And I took a deep breath because this is somebody that I care about and she cares about me and I know that. And I said, well, you know, I read the transcript last night and this is some more information. And so the discussion got easier because she had different reports. I mean, she had different sources of information. She had different information than I had at that point. And so we were able to talk about it and take the conversation a little bit further. I'm not saying we ended up on the same page, but I think the conversation went further. And I think there's a need for more of that in general. And I think, you know, for me personally as well. So Reb's description of the of this process of the self and the co-arising of experience is helpful to me in trying to broaden the picture a little bit and stay in a respectful stance with people when I am coming from different positions. A couple of other things I wanted to read that, you know, in terms of the how to go about this that I think he's addressing. By thoroughly contemplating such intracyclical conversations between self, awareness, and its objects, you realize there is no self aside from awareness and the objects of awareness. Awareness and its objects account for all experience. This is not to say there is no self. It's just that there is no independent self. The self exists only in dependence upon mind and its objects. When you clearly observe the dependent co-arising of self, mind, and objects, the belief in a self independent of mind and objects drops away. Being relieved of such narrow vision, we joyfully and gratefully observe how any praiseworthy qualities that manifest through our being are entirely due to the kind support of others. He also referenced in this chapter the fact that the ancient masters gave us examples of how they were able to express disagreement without disparaging the other, because they had a deep appreciation for each other. So a couple more things, and then I want to maybe move. I don't know what the timing is so far.
We're doing okay.
Okay. If we want to study the dependent co-arising of self and other, then we must be upright and gently enter into conversation with all beings. This conversation is a pivot in the process of liberation. It is the point where we turn from self-clinging to self-forgetting. It is extremely joyful, but it is rarely easy. It requires complete presence and total devotion. Okay. I think that's kind of made the point from that. You know, I think when I think about this, it's, you know, I think that I see a lot in a lot of places in our culture and in my own personal life where you can, someone has a perspective, but there's a larger view. And it's always neat when you see different points of view where people are able to talk to each other, where there's a discussion where different points of view are able to be held, and there's an interaction. It's harder when communication gets stopped and you've got kind of pillars of separate feelings and there's not an interaction. And I think, you know, there are different places to look for this. I saw this one article last week, and one of the pastors in Ferguson literally started doing a fellowship dinner of black and white community members, a potluck, and so people who had never kind of shared that kind of a social activity together, who were from that community, did come together. There was a motivation for it to happen. So it was Pastor Daryl Meese, and he, you know, just talked about the fact that it was neat just that people, you know, began conversation and realized all the shared interests that they had. So that's just one example. But I'm curious if people have examples of this or want to talk about what they, you know, just what, thinking about the change process, thinking about what helps people become unstuck. You know, just one more thing before I throw it open for some discussion. With the couples, when I'm working with them, when I'm looking for what would help shift this, you know, often I have to back up and appeal to what they do agree on. You know, so you can't, you kind of have to back up from the thing that has them so polarized and look at what is the larger scope and in what ways are they able to talk to each other? Or are they in agreement on what goals they have? Also, that they need time to be together when they can relax, and it's not always that an argument has to be solved or a task has to be done. So having time to be together for people to get to know each other is also an extremely important, you know, things that build community are important part of this. But I'm curious if anyone has a comment or observation they'd like to share.
Thank you, Kathy. Very, I think, very helpful way to start talking about something that's difficult. So please, if you have comments, responses, questions, feel free. David.
It's just interesting in my own practice. Just recently, looking at Kanzaiyong, is dedicating my practice to Kanzaiyong. And reading about it in Tygen's book, and it's just taking a look at others rather than myself. It's almost like, in a certain sense, Kathy, it's that it's not, we're always looking to change the other. In reality, what it has to be is us who are willing to be open to change.
Mm-hmm.
And this feeling that's so grounded in our practice, at least from what I'm reading, you know, in Kanzaiyong or Kano, is this compassion, a sense of compassion, being able to hear others, I think is you know, and in my own life, trying to reconcile with my daughter after divorcing just recently, and it's got to be, what do you want to say to me? I have to hear what you have to say to me. Not so much, I have to justify myself for my actions, but being able to listen. And that's the most important thing. And that's the only way we'll probably, as a father and daughter, be able to draw close, is to have that compassion and be able to listen to her.
Thank you. You know, that reminds me, so one of the interventions, the longer intervention that comes out of like the Rapoport kind of instigated, that's a couples therapy intervention technique, is it raises that issue. You know, it's a technique that works like this. The speaker is allowed to talk about what they feel, what is on their mind, explain an issue in depth. The listener is to listen carefully, not only to be able to rephrase what the person's saying, but also to read between the lines and pick up on the affect. And then they eventually ask the speaker, is that all? And often the speaker it opens up more and they go deeper and they begin to say, well, you've made me think of this, and they talk about more. And that needs to go on until the speaker is finished. And the listener, you know, and that they say that the listener has understood and has voiced it. And then it goes the other direction. You go through that process before you get into, you know, the listener voicing their position. What I think is difficult about that, it's like you're asking someone to let go of the urgency. You know, as they listen, they immediately have this reaction of, but you don't, you know, it's like, it's just kind of, and it's like it takes a relaxing to, right now, I just want to know what's making you tick around this topic. And you really have to step back and get your own stuff out of the way to be able to do that, which is a certain relaxing, getting grounded, and realizing you don't have to intervene constantly. Yeah.
Laurel.
Thank you so much, Kathy. I can't think of anything more important for us to think about than how to get past this horrible polarization that we're all in. I mean, one difference between sort of public polarization and the people you're dealing with is that the people that you're dealing with at least have some interest in trying to talk to each other. So I wonder if you have any thoughts about that part of it in the public arena, because I don't see it. I see people that I agree with talking with such anger and on such high horse about how right they are. And I agree with them, and I'm so mad at them, because it just adds to the ugliness of the whole difficulty. And I just search for ways to find a human being in there to relate to on some authentic emotional level, or even intellectual level, you know, some real communication in there, and not just, but I know these 10 things, goddammit, and they're important, so, you know, and if you're not doing something about it, there's something wrong with you. And on and on and on, and that's, and you hear it from both sides. Yeah. But it's really frustrating to me when I hear it from people that I agree with, and it's like, well, there's something wrong with the way we're about this.
I agree. No, thank you. That's well said. I've found myself in groups of people, you know, whether it's friends or whatever, where it's like sometimes there are heated issues and people feel so strongly that we can't even talk about them. You know, maybe we're all on the same page, but it's still, it's like there's such strong feeling that we can't even And I often think, why can't we just talk, why can't we talk about the nuances, you know, that, but, you know, one thing I think is community, you know, like, where do we all have to encounter each other? It's, you know, whether it's schools, parents take, you know, who have kids in schools, or whether it's our, you know, local block club meetings, or it's whatever pulls people together, you know, we're part of a larger community. I think that is on the decline, and I think we have to find ways to be more in the larger community. You know, like I was thinking about the ecumenical service, which I haven't been to, but I think that is such a neat idea just because it pulls together all the different denominations at Thanksgiving and maybe some people who are not that like-minded, but it's neat that they come together.
You mean the one at Rockefeller Chapel? Oh, yeah, that's really beautiful.
Yeah, I'm always out of town.
I wonder whether humor and federalism can be partly used in effectively.
Humor and what?
Federalism, analogies, and giving examples.
Yeah.
And can it be partly used effectively?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes. You know, like sometimes I find myself going there because I really don't want to enter this, you know, intensity. And one time at the end of a session, a new couple said, but you don't understand, this is serious, or something like that. And I had to convey, I do get it. I do get this has caused an awful lot of problems. But no, I think you're right. And it takes time to feel like you're not going to lose something if you allow yourself to be lighter. It's, yeah.
David? One more thought, if I may, we talk about the public arena.
Mm-hmm.
I took Al Gore's Climate Reality Project training about a year and a half ago. And actually on the first day, almost half the day was spent on learning to listen to others and to address their fears, that if I come in and just barge in and say, you have to do this, this, and this, I'm going to push people away. And it was very, very structured in a way that was the first thing they wanted you to hear, that we have to be willing to find out what's going on for the other people, what their fears are, what their concerns are.
Right.
And if we do that, then at least we open the door, possibly open the door.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't do that in public discourse, we're just too clingy points of view.
Mm-hmm. I've read that, and that's, thanks for bringing that in. I have realized something I read recently, that there are a lot of people not engaging in the discussion because they're, you know, the language is being used, or they just assume that it's something they don't agree with. And so how to open the conversation in a different way is important in terms of engaging people who do have a fear or who just don't believe it's real.
Cassidy.
It's a question.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of both on a personal level and on the larger social sphere. Personally, I did marriage counseling, and I am divorced, and I feel like I end up surrounded by egotistical partners, and I feel like when you were saying how it's important to speak and to have those conversations more, I was relating to that because I used to do that when I was younger, and now I've become much more reserved in sharing my opinion on things. And I consider myself a very good listener, but I don't speak my opinions as freely as I used to. And I think that's kind of been affected by being around egotistical people that don't really listen. They are very like, these are my 10 reasons, and I don't really want to be open to anybody else's perspective. Mm-hmm. So my question is, how, as someone who does want to relate to other people and does feel that they can listen, get an opportunity to be heard or encourage people to listen to what you have to say as well? Because for me, I feel like I can do my end of that conversation, but I don't know how to get people to be open-minded to listen to me too. So I've been very reserved.
Thank you. I mean, that's a... There's a lot there. There's two parts to it. You know, I do think you have to be persistent, you know, and put your position out there. I think you have to maybe search for ways to do that. I think sometimes listening carefully, too, can help sort out how to engage in the dance and also have the opportunity to do that. But sometimes you have to be more adamant or persistent or, you know, and I don't think that's the same thing as being in a conflict and not listening. You know, I think there are times to be more forceful.
Mm-hmm. Time for maybe one last comment if anyone has something else. Yes, Hector.
It's a quick question. After all your years of experience working with couples, what has been the one thing you've learned that you wish you had known when you started living with a partner?
Wish I'd known when I started living with a partner?
Yeah. Was there one thing you've learned that you wish?
Yeah, good question.
Oh, I wish I was older, for one thing. You know, that my ego, my identity didn't depend on, you know, that winning the argument. You know, not that I always wanted to win, but that, you know, that I would be able to step back and really listen and to do more to try to get the conversation going again. I think that we don't know so much, you know, it's like there, so the other thing about couples therapy is, you know, it's like you fall in love, you think this person is wonderful. After some period of time, you realize sometimes they're not so much. And so it's reality of, you know, they've got their faults too, and it's like, oh, I didn't know about those before, or how did I end up? You know, it's like, and it's like you realize then that marriage or, you know, a relationship is really, it's work at, and a willingness to work together to kind of with each other. And you don't know that sometimes when you go into marriage. You have much more of an idealized view of the process. So I think I wish I'd known that more, too.
Thank you. Good question. Good response. Yeah. Let's close with the four Bodhisattva vows. This last page of the chapter.
Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma days are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.